This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The governance structure for schools in Vermont can be a little confusing. For example, the Department of Education lists 280 school districts. We only have 251 towns. Plus, that's the administrative definition. When you define districts for funding, there are 290. Then there are tech center districts and other entities that bring the total up over 330. By and large, it's the role of superintendents to oversee these districts and supervisory unions. They have to negotiate contracts and issues across several independent schools. There are 62 superintendents in Vermont. Recent difficulties in the Burlington School District with the education budget, and before that, questions about racial bias, have highlighted the role of the superintendent in shaping the financial stability and culture of the schools he or she oversees. So today we're going to learn more about how the role of superintendent works in the educational system and why some say it's hard to recruit qualified candidates in Vermont. Joining me is Jeff Francis, Executive Director of the Vermont Superintendents Association. Jeff, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you, Jane. Good to be here.
That organization named Brent Kay Superintendent of the Year this year. He runs the Orange Southwest Supervisory Union, which includes Randolph, Brookfield, and Braintree. And he joins us as well. Hi, Brent.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, and congratulations on your award.
Thank you very much.
So, Jeff Francis, can you explain better than I did the role of the superintendent?
I actually thought you gave a great description of the role of the superintendent because in the leadership role that the superintendent plays, he or she is responsible for essentially all the functions of the school system. So when folks ask that question, I say it's a chief executive official position and a chief education leader position. The superintendent works closely with the school board or school boards in determining the direction, the goals, the strategies for the school system. And then once those things are determined, he or she works with the leaders in the school building and the faculty and staff to make sure that those plans, ideas, objectives are well executed.
So, Brent Kay, maybe you can give us a better understanding of on the ground what that looks like. Can you explain what you do all day?
A lot of meetings.
Right.
Typically, I'll average over 100 meetings a month.
My goodness.
To give you an idea.
That's a lot of meetings.
It is, but they're important. And for me, I don't mind meetings as long as we're functioning well as an organization. And whether you're a school district or a bank or an insurance company, or it doesn't really matter for me. A high-functioning organization specifically and explicitly outlines its desired outcomes. And it monitors rigorously whether or not it's achieving them. So I obviously play a vital role in bridging the relationship that our boards and trustees play in setting those directions, and then working with our staffs and administration and teachers and kids, quite honestly, and parents and community members in helping us achieve those objectives.
So when you're meeting with those people 100 times in a month, what kinds of things are you discussing?
Boy, it could be anything from implementing one of five major new initiatives that we're implementing this fall, just one being, for example, our new partnership with Middlebury Interactive, putting a full-year Spanish immersion program in for juniors and seniors. Just that one new program alone has required probably thousands of hours of work of multiple numbers of people bridging several different organizations. So you imagine the meetings that have taken place just to get us to the point where we're ready to implement.
So, Jeff Francis, is it difficult for superintendents to generally to have to navigate, you know, all the things that Brent Kay was just telling us about? And you've got different schools with different leadership, and each school also usually has a school board that you're dealing with, and the schools operate independently from one another and are often in different towns. Is that difficult for a superintendent?
I think it is. And again, at the beginning of the show, you talked about the various ways of counting our school districts and the multiple organizational structures. Vermont is somewhat unique in the country in terms of the way we deliver education. There are some similarities in New Hampshire and Maine that have systems that somewhat resemble what we have in Vermont. But in most other states in the nation, the organization of public education is along the lines of pre-K to 12 or K to 12 systems. In Vermont, we have 62 superintendents. we have 11 single school districts that are school districts like Montpelier and Milton and Colchester and Winooski, where you have one board presiding over the school system. We have 48 supervisory unions, which are entities that serve multiple districts that range in Vermont from 2 districts to 14 districts. And then we have 3 tech center districts, which were spawned in the early 2000s when the legislature passed a law that said a tech center could create a district unto itself. And of the 15 tech centers that we have in Vermont, 3 of them chose to do that. So what we say when we talk with superintendents or when superintendents talk with others is that if you're a superintendent in one place, it doesn't mean that you've been a superintendent or have familiarity with a position in another place. And if you can imagine just the challenge of, for example, moving from a place where you worked with one board, maybe 3 or 4 schools, the faculty and staff, to a place where you might work with as many as 14 boards, maybe 10 or 11 schools, because we have a number of non-operating school districts in Vermont. It all in pursuit of providing the best education opportunities possible at the most affordable cost for the Vermont community. Yeah, you can see how the position could be pretty challenging. When you layer on top of that what is really an annual array of new programmatic or regulatory or statutory obligations, things have a tendency to get complicated exponentially.
Like Common Core, is that a kind of thing that might come in to complicate things?
Common Core is an example of that. Brent could speak on that if you wanted to. But, you know, this year, for example, but most of these things are good things. We have a new universal access to pre-K law. Last year, we passed a very good bill for personalized learning plans and early college. Last year or the year before, there was a new law passed in terms of keeping track of vaccination rates in schools. Last year, there was a concussion management law that was passed. So those are just examples. Every year, there's a new assortment, and usually the manifestation of those laws go right to the central office where the superintendent presides, and he or she has the opportunity to figure out how those laws are going to be executed at the local level.
We're talking today about the role of the superintendent in Vermont schools. And listeners, if you have questions about how the job works or want to know more about why recruiting can be so difficult or what it's like in your district, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Maybe you're a teacher or you've been on the school board and you have some firsthand experience about how this all works and the role of the superintendent in your job. So you can tell us that. Jeff Francis, Brent Kay mentioned a moment ago that just because you've been a superintendent in one place doesn't mean that you really know the job in another place. And I understand that you were once a superintendent in Saskatchewan, right? So you have some different perspectives here.
I absolutely do. So it's Brent, and Jeff made that comment, but I'll respond to your query. It is, in essence, the process of education and special education and how they interrelate are very similar, even in Canada to the U.S. But the nuances of in the role of the superintendent is very different. So, for example, in Saskatchewan, I was a superintendent of administration for a district that spanned nearly 6,000 square kilometers and had 14 communities and 3 other townships. And I not only managed the finances for the school system, but I collected all municipal taxes too. And it wasn't uncommon for me to walk down the street to go to the bank with several million dollars in my satchel. So it was just a very different role in some ways, but the purpose of the superintendent at its heart is to ensure that the an equal educational opportunity for all children is met. So in that way, it's similar.
When Jeff talked about, though, the difficulties with all of the districts that we have and how many different kinds of things you're doing, and you talked a little bit about this as well, Brent, does that frustrate you coming from a different system?
No, I like change, and I tend to embrace change, and I always try to look at adversity with opportunity. I think Vermont's in a particularly challenging point at this time. Just to give you an example, 12 years ago when I first came to Vermont, because the superintendency can be a lonely position, maybe in some ways that's a good description, because there aren't a lot of people who understand really what you're doing. So I reached out and formed the Green Mountain Collaborative with four neighboring supervisory unions so that we could share our thoughts and help each other through the daily rigors of what we do. And in those 12 years, I've met 18 new superintendents in those other four positions.
Wow. So that's got to tell you something about the difficulty of the job.
Yeah, I think there are a number of reasons for that. I also think that it requires an inordinate amount of hours and an inordinate amount of concentration and time on task, and people don't always choose to do it as long as I have.
How long have you been at the Orange Southwest Supervisory Union?
12 in Randolph, Brookfield, and Braintree, serving those communities, and our tech center, of course, serves 21 sending towns from that region.
Wow, okay. So you're like the old man now in the Superintendents Association. Wow. Yeah, go ahead.
In many ways, I don't look old.
No, I'm sure you look very young.
but it's also a really humbling position to be in, because when I see new superintendents willing to step up and take charge and come into a much needed void in leadership in our school districts, it's nice to meet with them and talk with them and help share the experiences that other veteran superintendents shared with me when I was learning the ropes.
Well, maybe we can get back to some of the ways that superintendents can streamline things or cut costs a little bit later, because, Brent, you've taken us into this area of turnover, and that's one of the things that we want to discuss. Jeff Francis, you know, Brent mentioned that he's seen, 18 different superintendents in the four roles in the time since he set up that organization. Why is the turnover rate so high?
Well, the turnover rate varies from year to year. This year, for example, of the 62 entities that have employ a superintendent in Vermont, we have 18 changes in position. 9 of those are due to retirement. 4 superintendents are leaving their current position to pursue other endeavors. 4 are moving to new positions, other superintendencies in Vermont. And 1 was made a permanent position or from an interim status position. Last year, there were 9 turnovers, and the prior year, 7. So this year is high. I think that while the turnover this year is noteworthy, the bigger issue is what is the pool that's available to replace the folks who are leaving. And what we're seeing in Vermont and, frankly, in other states across the country is a increasingly shallow pool for folks who are willing to step up and do the job. In Vermont, I think that it's a combination of the challenges that the job holds for people, a recognition that there is dissimilarity from place to place with respect to how the job is structured, in some instances, the unwieldy nature of the systems. And in other places, quite frankly, or in another circumstance, is the fact that a lot of folks make decisions when they consider leadership position opportunities in education to stay where they are. So we've got folks who are principals who would be great superintendents who are really happy with the principalship. And I think we have fantastic teachers in Vermont who would, frankly, make very, very good principals and eventually superintendents who make a decision that they want to be close to the kids. And one of the things that contributed to Brent's selection as the superintendent of the year is he really is a case study in how you function as a superintendent and stay very, very close to the kids on a daily basis.
Yeah. How do you do that, Brent?
I make time. I take pride in trying to get to know every student in all of our schools and all of the towns, and I visit schools and classrooms regularly. So that allows me to get to know all of our staff, too, and I try to be visible. I get to as many extracurricular activities as I can, often at the invitation of students or teachers or parents that say it's great to see you and all that, and I think that helps me make much sounder decisions. You know, I tend to live by the adage that the decisions I make affect the lives of other people, so I very much want to hear from the constituents of our school system, and they, quite frankly, give me great ideas every day. But if I could, I'd like to add to what Jeff said on the turnover issue, because Vermont's a very unique structure. It's rural, but I'm used to far more rural areas. But because of the size of our school systems, they're very small. And because of that, there are very few assistant positions, assistant superintendents, assistant business managers, assistant SPED directors, even assistant principals. And what that means is that we're very unique in that we don't have a natural training ability to get people up to speed to make the jump, for example, from a teacher to a principal or for a principal to a superintendent or into the SPED director role or the business manager role. So that size sometimes, I think, can cause us some troubles, because I was very fortunate to spend 4.5 years under Dr. Latticeur up in Canada, who taught me an awful lot about what I do today.
Right. So there's not that opportunity for mentorship or to have the experience in an assistant position so that you're qualified then to move up into, say, a superintendent's position.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
What I'd add, Jane, if I may, is that we do have some systems in Vermont that are conducive to just that type of leadership development. For example, Mary Moran, who is the superintendent down in the Rutland City School District, which is a pre-K to 12 district in Rutland, makes a concerted effort to have folks in sort of line for leadership positions. So she operates with a K-12 district and focuses on leadership development within the system. Elaine Pinckney, who is the superintendent for the Chittenden South Supervisory Union, which is Charlotte and Shelburne and Hinesburg and communities in that vicinity, she does the same thing in terms of identifying prospective leaders and working with them so that they have a developing cadre, as it were, of leaders that are ready to come into the positions. But when I comment about the dissimilarity from place to place, not every place can do that. And I think the other comment that I would make with respect to that is Brent's able to do that in his system because he, in fact, has a system. And one of the things that he talks about very articulately is what he found in the Orange Southwest Supervisory Union when he got there 12 years ago and what he's now done to create an educational system among the three districts that are within his supervisory union. He's done a nice job at that. It's taken some time. But when you consider the size of some of our supervisory unions with 8 or 10 or 12 or 14 school districts, that sort of evolution to a systematic approach for management is, I think, regarded by some as an impossibility.
Well, we'll get into that a little bit more. We're also going to look at things like salary. Is that affecting the kinds of candidates you get or people making their decisions about whether or not to be superintendents? And we're going to talk a little bit about how this dearth of candidates actually affects the system. We're talking about the role of the superintendent in Vermont schools. And listeners, if you want to chime in, if you've got a question for our guests, or if you want to talk a little bit about what you know about how it works in your neck of the woods, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Jeff Francis is executive director of the Vermont Superintendents Association. Brent Kay is superintendent of the Orange Southwest Supervisory Union. They're both speaking with us today about the role of the superintendent in Vermont's educational system. And listeners, if you have questions about what the job entails or why it can be difficult to recruit and retain good candidates, call 1-800-639-2211 or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page. That's at vpr.net. Jeff Francis, what about salary? When it comes to enticing candidates into this role that we've talked about, can have many, many meetings and very long hours and a lot of different people that you're trying to corral and work with, is salary a problem in Vermont?
You know, I get that question occasionally, and rarely do I hear folks talk about the salary of the position once they're in the position. So in Vermont, the average salary for a superintendent is $115,000 a year, which I think by under any standard in Vermont in the public sector is a well-compensated position. when you consider it in terms of the demands of the position or what somebody might receive in a comparable position in the private sector, I think it's – I wouldn't characterize it as low, but I think it's reasonable.
In other states perhaps. I mean, other states have higher averages than do as well.
And one of the things I think that we experience from a standpoint of recruitment is that because we are in an area of the country that invests a lot of money in public education, that being the Northeast, if you go south to Massachusetts or Connecticut or Rhode Island, the salaries in general are a lot higher. New York also. If you look at Maine and New Hampshire, they're more similar. But I really don't think, and Brent can comment on this, that money's the factor. I think that by and large, the folks that find themselves in these positions are committed to children, they're committed to the process of public education, and they aspire to leadership positions. I think that we've got it's great that we've got the superintendents in place that we have. I think the issue is how the job's structured, what the demands of the job is or are. And I think that really contributes more to the shortage of candidates that we see.
And you don't think that having a higher salary would help at least ease the perhaps frustration of working so many hours, that the compensation might make you feel like it was more worth it?
Well, maybe it would, but, you know, it's all relative. And I think that if we were to survey the superintendents about their satisfaction with the compensation, I think that most would say that they were satisfied.
Have you done that?
No, I have not, but maybe I will as a follow-up. The other thing is that, you know, in the deliberations or debates that we have about the school governance structure, sometimes folks say, well, we want to reorganize the delivery system in order to make superintendents' lives easier. Mm-hmm. And my response to that is always, these folks who are serving as superintendents are party to a two-party agreement where they sign an employment agreement going into the job knowing what it is they're getting. So when we have conversations about the delivery system, it is not in an effort to appease or satisfy superintendents. It's what would a delivery system look like that makes the best use of the precious resources that we have across the board, monetary, all of our personnel, school board's time, and so on and so forth. But I think that the whole issue of the pool really has to do with the way the job is structured, the fact that folks may be satisfied in the positions that they're at. And it's a highly personal decision to make a determination that you want to be a superintendent.
Brent, you want to chime in here? Because obviously we need superintendents. You know, so what do you think would make the job more appealing or, you know, get the right people in there? Which is not to say we don't have the right people now, but if the turnover is as much as 15% on an average year, that's a lot.
Yeah, I agree. And what we obviously want to do is make the job doable. I don't hear superintendents complain about their salary, and I don't hear them complain about the hours they work. You know, personally, anyone who knows me, regardless of what role I've been in, I work a lot of hours. It's just who I am, and I like my work. So I love kids, and so that drives me. And my wife, thankfully, knows when to tell me to take a break. But I think the structures in Vermont are challenging. If you have 6, 8, 10, or 14 boards that don't want to work together or haven't worked together in the past, and they move in 6, 8, 10, or 14 different directions, then the school system can be unruly and very difficult to manage, because you could have as many as 6 different collective bargaining agreements or 6 different policy manuals or 6 different sets of directions. And so it's a lot easier to lead a district if there's cooperation and collaboration among those. And you know, I'm very fortunate to serve in a supervisory union where my school boards and administrators and communities understand and value the collaborative process and how it can actually better serve kids.
Given that school boards are so independent and schools themselves are so independent, do we even need superintendents, Brent? And then, Jeff, I'll make sure you get a chance on that one, too. I'm not trying to put you out of a job, given that you've just been named superintendent of the year, but
Well, believe it or not, it's funny you say that. I view my job as to create a system that's sustainable so it doesn't have to rely on me. So that goes into the perspective. But I think if we want to ensure that all kids have an equal educational opportunity and that there's equity on the front lines, which I think we struggle with in Vermont, then you've got to have somebody that plays that role of looking at all kids. And I'm one of the few positions in the supervisory union that I respect and value the uniqueness of the schools and the towns that I serve. I don't look at our kids independently that way. I look at them as our kids holistically, and how do we make sure that they have the same quality and consistency of opportunities that all kids have, trying not to leave somebody behind.
My view on that is the better folks to feel that question are principals. Because principals, by definition, are focused on what transpires in their building and leading the process of teaching and learning within that building. That is an extraordinarily important role in the public education delivery system. And when you consider my comment earlier about all of the requirements that are coming down from above, it is really the job of the superintendent to make sure that all those requirements are well organized so that the individual schools can respond to those requirements. And without the essential position of superintendent, you would have an infinite number of new obligations, duties, and requirements that would go right to the principal and right to the school, thereby making the job of the principal as building leader and leader of teachers and educational leader in the building impossible.
So you do think of it as an essential job, Jeff Francis?
Absolutely. There's no question about it. And it's I think that's been proven by how other states organize their delivery system, and frankly, the role that the superintendent plays in Vermont, sort of fielding the wide array of requirements and initiatives, helping to put them in an orderly fashion, and supporting the important work of the principals that they undertake in the school buildings themselves.
Jeff, how does it affect the school system, though, if we're having the same small pool of applicants for the same four or five open jobs, you know, that they're sort of traveling around to these different open jobs and you've got the same applicants?
That's extraordinarily challenging, and it's a realization that we came to the year before last when we saw what was happening with the numbers of superintendents that were retiring, and the search consultants who largely work with the School Boards Association repeatedly told us that that they didn't have enough qualified candidates for positions when they opened up. So this year, meaning the beginning of the school year that started in July 2013, the Superintendents Association initiated something we call the Leadership Academy, where we spend 9 full days with superintendents who are in the early years of their tenure or folks who are aspiring to the superintendent's position. And we gave them 9 days of professional development focused on the necessary skills and knowledge that a superintendent should have when he or she starts a position. We had 30 people participate in that program. And it was so successful that we're doing it again in the coming year. We have 20 registered for what we refer to as the Superintendent's Leadership Academy 1. And of the 30 folks who participated in that program this year, 15 asked for a higher level of instruction and professional development. So we've initiated Superintendent's Leadership Academy 2, which, if you looked at on a collegiate model, would be the equivalent of level 200 and 300 coursework in areas like effective leadership and governance, education funding, human resources management, curriculum, instruction, and assessment. There are an array of other topics that we cover, but just the explanation of the topics gives you some insight into what it is the job of the superintendent.
So you think we'll get more qualified candidates moving forward through initiatives like this?
I do. And I also think that as more school districts take a look at the value of creating stronger systems and working more together, I think that that will contribute as an inducement to more folks joining the superintendency as well.
And if I could add, I'll give you an example. of the really different role of a superintendent versus a principal. Our principals largely are trained in expertise and have expertise in education and being instructional leaders in their buildings. But when you talk to principals, often they don't have much opportunity to be an instructional leader because they're focusing on the business side of the equation, whereas superintendents more so focus on that area. And if they can do that work and allow the principals to be the instructional leaders that they're trained to be, then I think schools function better and I think our kids receive a better education.
Before we let you both go, Jeff, maybe you can tell us what makes Brent so good at his job that he would be the superintendent of the year.
Sure. When I joined the Superintendents Association, I surveyed a large number of folks and said, what makes an effective superintendent? And the chair of the Education Committee at the time, David Larson from Wilmington, said to me, Jeff, at their best, superintendents function as pragmatic visionaries. And I think that term describes Brent. A pragmatic visionary understands what you want to accomplish for the children of the state of Vermont and how to do it in the most practical and realistic terms possible. And I think that superintendents that function as pragmatic visionaries meet both the challenge of the future, and they do it with the realization of what they're contending with from a resource standpoint and a delivery structure.
That was Jeff Francis. He's executive director of the Vermont Superintendents Association. Jeff, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
And that pragmatic visionary he's talking about, one of them anyway, is Brent Kay. He's superintendent of the Orange Southwest Supervisory Union. And he was named 2014 Vermont Superintendent of the Year by the Vermont Superintendents Association. Brent, congratulations and thanks again.
Thank you.
Coming up, we're going to stay in school. We'll profile a group of students learning about biology through hands-on fish rearing. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Many middle school students have to learn about water cycles, fish habitat, and the impact of pollution. But those lessons are a lot more fun when the students get to raise real fish, go to an actual stream, and get wet in the process. VPR's Nina Keck had a chance to see just such a program. It's called Trout in the Classroom, and she went with students from Manchester.
The rocky headwaters of the Meadowee River in Dorset run cold and clear, sparkling in the sun and pooling gently in shady spots. The winding stream is a veritable Shangri-La for brook trout and a favorite for fly fishing. On a recent afternoon, the stream also became an outdoor classroom for 46th graders from MEMS, Manchester Elementary and Middle School.
All right, well, welcome to our trout release day.
Yay!
Rachel Mark teaches 6th grade at MEMS.
I know that it's with mixed emotion that we're all here because, I don't know about you, but I started to have a little trout sadness and grief last night that they won't be in our class anymore.
Last fall, Mark's students received 200 fish eggs from the state hatchery in Roxbury and raised them in a 750-gallon tank. Rachel's father, Joe Mark, is the lead facilitator for Vermont's Trout in the Classroom program. He came to his daughter's school several times to teach the kids about how to care for the fish.
It's actually a pretty challenging thing to do because the water chemistry, once they start feeding and defecating, the water chemistry can change in 24 hours, and you can start losing fish very, very rapidly.
He and another volunteer lift the lid on a large cooler where the 57 surviving fingerlings await their freedom.
They look good.
They look great?
Yeah.
Before the students can release the trout, however, they need to gather and identify insects the trout will eat, complete a stream study worksheet, and finally write a poem about the project. With nets, magnifying glasses, and dreams of getting soaked, the kids break into groups and head for the water.
Okay. So you got the clipboard, you have the net, you have the bucket. Spencer's going to be responsible for that.
Parent volunteer Jim Miranda and his group walk along the stream's muddy shoreline for a few minutes before stopping at some rocks.
Within this little area right here, there's thousands of aquatic insects.
All right, let's jump in.
It's probably pretty chilly. I didn't bring my thermometer with me.
When you're standing in the water, it is definitely really cold. I'd say it's about
I don't know, like 10 degrees. It's really, really cold.
The cold doesn't seem to keep anyone out of the water, however, and 12-year-old Renee Hale and her classmates quickly get to work.
We use the net in the water. The insects are usually underneath the rocks, so when we put the net down and kick the rocks a little bit, the bugs would come out and float into the net.
What are you guys finding? Oh, I recognize something there, huh?
I recognize some of the mayflies that we've been studying.
Oh, my gosh.
There's a little head sticking out.
There's a bunch of things in here.
It's coming out. Oh, my God.
Miss Rice, it's coming out. It's coming out of its cocoon. I just think it's really cool how, like, if you turn over a rock, you'd find, like, these bugs that, like, the trout eat and stuff like that.
Sixth grader Aaron Iannuzzi uses tweezers to move a bug to a white tray that holds their growing collection. She points out caddisflies, mayflies, and stoneflies, all good eating for their trout, and all dependent on clean water.
Before this, I didn't really think, when I thought of pollution, I more thought about, like, the humans and what it's going to do. But now, after this trout, I've learned about the animals that live in here and what pollution can do to them.
Iannuzzi and several other sixth graders say they're relieved their trout will have such clean water to live in.
I actually named one of the trout. I named it Finn, and I'm going to be very sad to watch Finn go, but, you know, it's better for the trout to be in the wilderness. So that was pretty much the point of this, to watch them grow and everything and then send them off into the river.
Towards the end of the field trip, the group finds a shaded pool where the water moves more slowly. And one by one, the trout are set free.
Oh, yeah, there it is!
Right there!
I see
him!
There he goes!
Take one!
The small fish quickly disappear from view as they make their way into the rushing water.
Goodbye!
For VPR News, I'm Nina Keck in Dorset.
And now it's time for your messages to the program. Producer Sage Van Wing joins me. Sage, what would you name a fish?
Oh, tricky. Flipper, maybe. Not that they have them. Last week, we talked about Vermont's aging population and, in a separate show, about the rising cost of health insurance premiums and the future of single-payer health care.
Mark was listening to both shows, and he had some thoughts about the overlap. I can only suppose, he writes, that since Vermont is the second oldest state in the U.S., that also holds true for our health care providers. I'm betting we'll see a large number of retiring providers in the next 3 to 4 years who will not be easily replaced.
And when we profiled the Barry Granite Company Rock of Ages, we heard from many of you on Facebook with connections to the industry. Martha wrote, "My great-grandfather E.L. Smith owned one of the original quarries. It's part of Rock of Ages now."
Kelly said she always takes out-of-town guests there, and Sheila shared, "My grandfather was a crane operator here for many moons."
It's always nice to hear about the many connections you have to the stories that we do.
On Monday, we learned about the vibrant landscape of summer theater programs around the state.
Jeffrey posted on Facebook, "Vermont has a great tradition of professional summer theater, as well as some great community companies. Some are long established, like Stowe Theater Guild in their full season, but also Bristol Gateway Players in its fourth season. This year, they're returning with Shakespeare Outdoors on the town green."
And Sean says, "I've worked as both an actor and a designer at Lost Nation Theater. The reason I keep returning is because of their passion and commitment. Whether just starting out in the business or a seasoned professional, Lost Nation welcomes you with open arms, challenges you as an actor or designer to put the best work you can on stage for the audiences, and allows you to be part of a theater family that's vast and ever-growing across the country."
Yesterday, we talked about all the books we're excited to read this summer, if you have time, that is, and heard some of your recommendations as well. After the show, we got a note from Lee Goodman.
Yeah, Lee said, "Hey, I just had a call saying my book, Indefensible, was mentioned on your show today. That's great news. I'm from Vermont, and I went to UVM, although I live primarily in Alaska now. I am thrilled to have Indefensible mentioned on public radio because I think of my book as a literary mystery, and I think of the VPR audience as intelligent and discriminating. I hope your listeners will pick up the book."
Well, we think of our listeners as intelligent and discriminating, too. Sally really wanted to read some of the books mentioned yesterday. She asked, is there any way a list of all the books talked about can be posted?
In fact, there is. We managed to write down most of the suggestions from yesterday's show. You can find them at our website, vpr.net. Sage, thanks.
You're welcome.
Tomorrow, we're going to talk about first jobs. We want to hear what you learned from your first job, how to keep a schedule, maybe be nice to strangers or your boss. Send your notes to Vermont Edition at vpr.net and listen tomorrow at noon.